Hello and welcome to edition 349 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Steve Bloomfield.
On today's show, we'll be meeting a singer and actor whose Arab heritage within the Israeli music scene has made her a prominent voice for representing divided cultures. Mira Awad will be joining us later.
Then we'll be discussing art and how to make the complex themes relatable for one of the most picky audiences in any gallery, children. Illustrator and author Marion Duchars will be explaining this and much, much more.
And we'll be enjoying hopefully not too many wee drams with whiskey experts Joel Harrison and Neil Ridley. They're heroically working their way through a different rare batch for every letter of the alphabet. Wish them and us luck.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be peering through the alcoholic fog to try to make out the shape of next week's news. And we'll be enjoying some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. How's your week, Steve?
It's been actually rather good.
I know, you're puffed up, aren't you? Because you've got a big bit of coverage about your radio show in the independent newspaper. Read all about it.
Yeah. Apparently. Well, I mean, obviously, you know, everyone knows all this already. But, you know, the Foreign Desk is the show to listen to. And the Independent wrote a very nice piece saying everyone should listen to it.
No, I think, I don't really want you to get too big an ego, but I think actually it was a very nice piece and very, very well deserved. Oh, God, that hurt me to say that.
But anyway, it did, didn't it?
Anyway, there you go. And otherwise, you've been... we have a new issue that's going to come out next week, which we've already seen sneak copies in the office.
It arrived with a thump and a thud. It is
I didn't mean to punch you.
Please don't do that anymore.
No, it's a mighty beast.
330 pages long, which you drop it on a table from only about, say, a foot, and it's got a real... I mean, I should have brought one in.
You should have done.
Anyway, never mind. It's got a real thump. It's not like some of these wishy-washy weekly magazines that sort of float down if you let go of it from a great height. This really will hurt. Slight problem. Is it going to fit through people's letterboxes?
Well, it may do. It may kill the cat when it arrives on the other side. That's the cat being killed. The other thing is just to remind people that it's 4 weeks until the Monocle Conference in Vienna, a quality of life conference where we have 25 amazing speakers coming to join us. It's a fast-packed, fun day, and then you get to spend time with the likes of me and Steve Bloomfield and Mr. Brulé come the evening on dance floors, at dinner tables, in conversations. And there are a few tickets left, so go to monocle.com to book now to make sure that you're our dancing partners.
Indeed. And who wouldn't want to be our dancing partners? I'm rather looking forward to it. And there's going to be a big team as well from Monocle HQ, from Midori House, heading out to Vienna.
I think some 30-plus people will be kind of en route to Vienna at some point over the next couple of weeks. Yeah, so very, very exciting. So we're looking forward to seeing people come. Should we get on with the show?
First, though, is Henry Rhys Sheridan on the invite list? Is he coming to Vienna?
Actually, I don't know. I hope so, because otherwise this is going to be really awkward. Henry, oh Henry, love the way you jump and rock. All right. Henry, oh Henry, love the way Texas hop. But how am I doing now? Everything is all right. Well, I'm very pleased to see you arrive in a Tyrolean titfer.
Excuse me?
That must mean I think you are coming, aren't you, to Vienna?
I hope I am. I believe I am. That belief may be misguided. We'll find out soon enough. But I'm certainly looking forward to it.
You're going to turn
whether
up
or not I'm coming.
You'll come to the airport anyway,
yeah,
packed with your bag and hope that you've got a ticket.
Maybe have a sandwich there. we'll see, at least.
All excitement, Henry.
I really am. Shall I go into the news? Should we do news?
Yes, that's why you're here.
For the week ahead, regional elections are taking place in Germany on Sunday the 13th. That's today. State elections are taking place in the German Länder of Baden-Württemberg, Rhineland-Pfalz and Sachsen-Anhalt.
What was that last one?
It was Sachsen-Anhalt, Steve.
Oh, okay, excellent.
It's the third state that elections are taking place in. Super Sunday, if you like. 12 million voters are going to be presented with a chance.
Super Sonntag.
Very good.
There we are. There they should have that as a theme tune, music.
Well, that's a kind of sting at the beginning of the election.
But Steve, an important day, because this is when it's kind of a bit of a verdict on Merkel's handling of so many things, but including the refugee crisis.
Yeah, mainly the refugee crisis. This is a sort of the big moment for Angela Merkel, and that's actually partly why these EU summits over the last few days, these talks with Turkey were so important for her, was to be able to say to German voters, look, it's OK, we've got this under control. My decision last September to let more people in has been vindicated, or at least hasn't been a massive problem. But we'll see, won't we, Henry, whether actually it does turn into a massive problem for her.
And there's a really interesting twist of logic in the polling for the elections, because although the CDU, Merkel's party, has relatively a poor forecast, Merkel's approval ratings herself are actually relatively high. And this is because a lot of people in the Green Party and on the left who oppose her party actually approve of her and of her refugee policies extremely strongly. So, funny little twist there. We'll see what happens. Mutti may hold on to power yet.
Good.
On Sunday the 13th, same day, Pope Francis is marking 3 years as the head of the Catholic Church. He is the first pope from Latin America, the first Jesuit pope, the first non-European pope of the modern era, and the first pope to be named Francis. He's a kind of sexy pope, isn't he? A kind of
I don't think you're allowed to say sexy pope. Is like
he's a kind of media darling pope.
That's fine.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine, because otherwise the thunderbolt will hit us in a second. That's
okay. I don't want to cause that to happen.
No.
I was in St. Peter's Square for his inaugural mass.
Were you?
Yeah.
What was it like?
It was quite
genuinely interested to see what it's like.
It was really actually quite interesting, because it was absolutely packed with people from all over the world, and everyone had brought their flags. So there were sort of Angolan flags and obviously lots of Argentinian flags.
It was like Glastonbury, which is what you're saying, and he was headlining.
It wasn't anything like Glastonbury.
Okay.
No.
Bit of football.
It wasn't really anything like that. It was, sorry, your references are just wrong.
Bit like a Pope thing.
It was like a Pope thing. Yes, exactly. It was like a Pope thing.
It was like the inauguration of a Pope.
But then what was funny, so he does this thing sort of in the square, and then he goes inside. And when he goes inside, it's sort of to meet all the heads of state and so on. And it was being shown on the big screen. And you saw all the different heads of state and ministers sort of coming up to meet him. But there was someone to his side who's sort of whispering his ear and saying, this is the president of Brazil. Okay, fine.
You can see this while I'm standing outside.
Yeah, you could see. They had it on a big screen, so you could see this gentleman who sort of would come into screen whispering Pope Francis' ear about who he's about to meet, and they'd be like, ah, Gordon Brown, so good to see you again.
Yeah, you were like grandparents watching your grandson or daughter's graduation ceremony over Skype because there's not enough room in the hall. That's what you're saying.
I'm a Jewish atheist, so no.
Okay. Again, I just thought I'd try to clarify things, throw an analogy out there. Incorrect again. Doesn't matter.
Give us a couple more, Henry.
A few more. Sunday 20th of March, the last print edition of The Independent of Sunday is being published today. It's been going since 1986. I'm sure you guys all know the story, but maybe listeners don't. They declared a few weeks ago that they are going to cease their print publication and move everything online except for the compact newspaper, I believe the term, the I, which is being sold. Well,
me and Steve know lots about this because we're both former residents of the Independent Towers.
I'm sure you have views on the issue then.
Well, sad. I think it's sad to see the newspaper go. I think it's a complicated time of negotiation for all of these brands. I don't think anybody can dispute that the Lebedev has put a huge amount of money into trying to keep the brand going. But it's kind of run out of steam a little bit as a print operation. Will it be able to pull it off in digital format only? It's not known. The I is being sold on to another newspaper player. It's a really intriguing time. And I don't think anybody who runs a newspaper, unless you're the New York Times perhaps or the Washington Post, is having much of a kind of a skip around the office these days. But it doesn't come a time when you think, OK, this is actually a really vibrant, sensible thing to do. You just feel that they have run out of steam in one direction and they have to think of something else.
Steve?
I completely agree with everything Andrew said.
Fantastic.
Can I just be clear? Only then.
Okay.
That's not a general agreement.
Sure.
But yeah, next Sunday will be a very sad day. It will be the last, that was where I started my career.
And
won't be where I end it.
A sad day indeed. But to end on a note of levity, I think,
yes.
Although I'm not sure what the significance of this religious festival is, on Monday the 14th.
Tomorrow.
Of March. Tomorrow, Monday the 14th of March. The annual Flower War will take place in the Greek seaside village of Galaxidi, which I almost certainly mispronounced. The annual traditional Flower War takes place each year in the Greek seaside village as part of the end of Carnival. A war is fought using coloured baking flour. What do you think I was talking about?
Plants.
We thought plants as in... But this is flour as in...
No, this is the baking flour.
That you make cakes with.
Yes.
Or bread or whatever.
Begs the question how you have a... As a projectile... it's quite kind of disparate, isn't it?
Although that's not best very... in my imagination, I saw kind of like grannies dropping geraniums in heavy pots off of kind of like balconies onto passers-by.
That would be
one amazing flower walk.
Extraordinarily dangerous. But obviously this doesn't get as much publicity as Valencia's famous La Tomatina. Tomato war. I'm sure you've all seen pictures of that.
I have seen them. Yeah.
Maybe if you want a break, tune into that. I don't know. Could be your thing.
Well, if you've got the tomatoes and the flour, you just need the eggs and you can make a pizza.
That would be... And it would morph into a kind of pizza war.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be a sight for sore
there's
eyes.
There's been pizza wars before, but they're different. They tend to be like, you know, Domino's versus pizza. Anyway, let's move on.
Retail war.
Yeah.
That's all I've got.
Yeah, we know.
That was enough.
We really know it, Henry. Henry, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing from the Arab Israeli singer and actress Mira Awad. Our first guest today is no stranger to the stage or attempting to unite audiences. Mira Awad is an Arab-Israeli singer and actress who represented Israel at Eurovision in 2009.
But her unusual background, she was raised by her Israeli-Palestinian father and Bulgarian mother, means that her music represents a hybrid of cultures that don't always sit easily alongside one another. Mira's was the first ever Israeli entry at Eurovision to feature lyrics in Arabic, and she's also starred in the hit Israeli TV series Arab Labour, and I'm very pleased to say she joins us now in the studio. Mira, welcome to The Monocle Weekly.
Thank you for having me.
That's quite all right. Let's start with that issue of who you feel you represent or who other people feel you represent, because as you've written yourself recently, sometimes people say you're a fig leaf for the Israeli government. Other people say that you are sort of supporting terrorism. Do you feel that you're sort of sometimes stuck in the middle?
Well, it took you a paragraph just to say what my identity is, so you can understand that it's walking a lot of thin lines all the time. For me, that question of who you are and what nationality are you, I could have thrown it out of the window in 1 second. But yeah, our reality kind of forces us to put ourselves in these boxes, suffocating boxes, if I may say. I'm Palestinian on one side. My father is Palestinian. Some call us Arab Israelis. We call ourselves Palestinians Israelis. And that's an issue of itself, of walking on some thin line where you're like...
And how do you self-describe then? How would you describe yourself? Which of those two options would you normally go for?
That's the thing. See, we're talking about this again because... Again, I'm Palestinian by heritage, I'm Israeli by citizenship, but I'm also Bulgarian. So it's a lot of identities that I live peacefully with. Not everybody around me can live peacefully with the combination of being Palestinian and Israeli at the same time. And I'm sorry to say that in my region, I feel that there is a request or a demand all the time to choose, as if you cannot be in the middle just wanting what's safe for everyone. You need to choose one camp, and I'm totally... I cannot choose a camp. I want what's best for the humankind, you know, if I may be philosophical a little bit.
You've obviously negotiated a kind of interesting spot, as you say, but you have become a kind of a focal point for, in a very positive way, for another narrative, which is, I guess, that many people who sit within Israeli society from the outside, you know, we tend to think of it as being very, very kind of unified, all one type of person. I know when I've been to Israel myself, when you get there, you suddenly realize, you know, you're speaking to somebody, as you say, who's Arabic, who remained in the country since the 40s, when all the changes happened. You feel people with all these different heritage, people came from Russia to live there. It's a very mixed, diverse group of people. But in the middle of it, there is a kind of a liberal leftist core who are hoping for some narrative in all of that's going on that will bring change. You seem to represent some of that. Maybe music is important of that. How did you end up finding yourself as this singer who people coalesce around, because the songs you sing are songs of hope, even in these tough times?
Well, I don't think I've ever aimed to be that symbol, you know. When I started out, I wanted just to be a musician. I just wanted everybody to talk to me about, you know, the songs that I composed. I did not want to talk politics or the future of Israel-Palestine or whatever. Really, seriously, when I was 18, I hated that. But with the years, I understood that not only that this is my story, but it is my mission. And I totally embraced it. And I said, okay, if I'm not going to talk about that, who is? And if I'm not going to keep the hope alive, who is? Because I feel that we're losing the hope. We're losing that vision of that possible solution. And it is possible. it can be solved. We just need to want to. The interests right now, the political interests, the money interests, whatever we want to talk about, are pointing in the other direction of keeping this dispute alive, because it's more politically...
But you meet in a day-to-day basis people who you come across who you feel, actually, you're like me. You know, your songs are, there must be another, there must be a better way tomorrow. You're full of hope. And you come across people who feel... that are like-minded like you, who think actually we can park our religious differences, our political differences, and we can find this different route.
Of course they are. Like you said, neither Israel nor Palestine are made of one opinion, okay? When you go there, you understand that it's not black or white, it's the whole spectrum of grays. And as the number of people, there's the number of opinions and ideas and feelings about what's happening. So, of course, there's a big amount of people who believe in, I don't want to call it peace anymore, because it's become a cynical word to say world peace and peace and have peace. It's lost its meaning. I'm talking about shared living, to share a land, to share a town, to share a building, to live with respect to each other and not kill each other, for God's sakes. That's so simple to do, right? Not so simple, apparently.
There are very few civil rights voices and leaders who get a chance to go and do Eurovision.
Right.
Interesting. But suddenly be in front of the microphone, the world is your audience.
Right.
And you were there with, you know, another Israeli singer.
Noah.
Yeah. And tell me, you know, that moment, doing Eurovision, were you there just to have fun, or did you realise even then that this has like so many interesting kind of and actually, let's be honest, you know, Israel has had an interesting history of the people it's chosen for Eurovision.
Yes.
It's kind of taunted the world with its kind of perplexity and its kind of conundrums.
So we were another conundrum.
Yeah.
we're just aliens, you know. listen, the whole thing of Eurovision, I mean, we remember to start to have fun, I think, only when we got to Moscow in 2009, because before that, we only had a very hard time. If I can remind you, 2009, we had the first Gaza operation happening, cast-led. And that was the time when we were trying to prepare for a pop contest in Eurovision, right? So how do you prepare for a pop contest when you're a peace activist watching the world crumble and people dying every day? It was a very hard time. We got criticized from every direction possible. Israeli MKs wanted me to withdraw because they claimed I had no respect for the symbols of the Israeli state, just because I said that the anthem does not include me as an Arab and the flag does not include me as an Arab, which is a fact. The flag has the Star of David, which is great, but it does not include me as a Palestinian. So they claimed that I have no respect for the symbols of the country and I should not be representing Israel. On the other hand, my fellow left-wing or Palestinians claimed, as you said before, that I am some kind of a fig leaf helping the Israeli PR to, you know, to beautify the face of Israel at that moment. They thought that the whole collaboration was some kind of a PR stunt made by the Israeli government. They did not know that we had been collaborating for 9 years before that, me and Noah. So we were attacked and we had to deal with all this noise while we were trying to write songs for Eurovision. So it was not the easiest entry in the world. I think only when I landed in Moscow, the war had ended already, the operation on Gaza had ended already. Only when we arrived and I landed there that I understood where I am, that I am in Eurovision. And I did have fun.
Good.
There was a lot of vodka around. Eventually, you know. And yes, about regarding the platform, it's a huge platform. Okay, we can laugh about Eurovision, but it's a huge platform. Millions of people watch this. And it does open a window to something. And we managed to open a window to at least to show that it's not black and white. And there are some people down there in that weird place called Israel and Palestine that really are trying to bridge the differences.
You said at the start about how you're hopeful and that if...
I try to be.
You try to be.
That, I really,
you know,
try
that
to
if
be.
You, if you're not, who is going to be?
Exactly.
Do you think that... Do you look at the younger generation in Israel now, whether they're Jewish, whether they're Palestinian, and think that they are hopeful and optimistic about a shared future?
it's difficult because I don't think, no, I think they are not hopeful. And that's what's so sad. They are not hopeful, not only because of the political situation, also because of the financial situation. So they have no prospects, you know. It feels like there's no prospect for that place. And a lot of young people are thinking of leaving and having normal life somewhere else. Why should they? You know, why should they be worried every day if somebody's going to stab them in the street or if occupation is going to ruin their house? I'm talking about both sides. But that's why I do so much work with youth. I meet a lot of young people, and there are many, many, many projects working with Israeli and Palestinian young people, making them meet, teaching them dialogue options or dialogue skills. You need the skill to know how to do a dialogue and not run away from the room and slam the door behind you. It's difficult sometimes to hear the other person's narrative because sometimes the other person's narrative stabs yours. But when you teach young people how to deal with the other person's narrative, you see beautiful things happening. So again, I'm saying it's not easy right now. The prospects are not there. But I want to hold to the hope that we are managing to do something. That with all these projects with young people and kids, we're managing to do something out there and grow a generation where there are people who believe that the other is not just a terrorist or an occupier.
And it's as we say, it's a small space that is available for this conversation. But do you think there is also this conversation, which was struck me when I went to Israel, when you spoke to some Arab people who were saying, what is interesting about us being citizens of Israel is, I spoke to a guy who was gay, and he was saying, actually, I couldn't live this life across the border in many other places around in the region. There is an irony that, you know, whatever happens, I'm kind of protected by Israeli society. There's conversations about women's rights, all sorts of things, that in a way that if you synthesize the best of all the things that are going on, there could be a really interesting, you know, meeting point of ideas and creating something very special.
In my ideal world, yes, we should have been a great place because of the diversity. But I mean, when you talk about gay people, to remind you, a Jewish Orthodox guy stabbed some people in the gay parade in Jerusalem. So it's not only the Arab world that is
not at all. I don't mean to make it. I don't want to be caught in your black and white conversation. Yeah. I'm just interested. There's a nuance at play there, I think.
For sure. But for sure, listen, I love the diversity that we have. I live in Tel Aviv and I love it. I love walking in the street and having everybody there. In an ideal world, the whole of Israel should have been like that, should have looked like that. And we should have included everybody. But we're not. That's the thing. It has these oases. This little state of Tel Aviv, for example, is that kind of a place. But when you step out, it's not like that. And you see how divided people live. Arabs live where they live, and the Jews live where they live, and the religious people live in certain places, and they don't mix. And so we have a lot of stereotypes and a lot of incitement going between the communities. And I would really, really, really want to change that. I don't know what power I have or other people like me, but that's the discourse is extreme right now.
As an artist, do you ever have personal frustrations that essentially many of your conversations are like this? Yes. They're not about your art.
I
and
did
what
try and bring it back to Eurovision.
I know.
Do you find that frustrating as an artist?
It is. It is sometimes frustrating because what I actually want to do is sing, perform, write, compose. And I do that. You see, that's what I do. What I actually make a living from is that. But I cannot ignore the fact that, yes, we are actually talking. Listen, how long have we been talking about it?
Let's talk about that. So what is it then that what's the thing that you want to work on next? What's your big dream of a big project?
You're an actress, you're a photographer, you're properly kind of multimedia.
Right, yes. Multidisciplinary for sure. Yeah. Well, I'm working on my third solo album, which will include songs both in Arabic and English. This time I'm musically producing it myself with the help of some friends, but I took charge of the musical production for the first time. I think I get the courage to say, okay, I'm going to say what's going to happen here, which is a lot of fun. For me, put me in the studio from the morning and get me out at night with a beer, that would be a good life. So I'm doing that right now. I'm recording and I'm shooting some video clips for the songs that I'm recording. I'm also a writer, so I'm writing a TV show for young people, and another drama series that I've written is supposed to also take off at some point. I'm doing a lot of things.
And do you feel that the industry, the cultural industry in Israel, is actually quite strong at the moment? There are opportunities.
Opportunities, not so much, but there is a lot of talent and very, very courageous people and stubborn. You have to be stubborn in order to make it in Israel right now, because it's not an easy time. We have a new minister of culture who does not like artists, that's to say the least, to my opinion, at least. And it's a big struggle for budgets and for freedom of creation right now that we are going through, and we're all going to fight for that.
Mira Awad, amazing to meet you. And those of you listening in London can see Mira in conversation tonight, Sunday, at JW3. Well, it's time for some music now, and we couldn't have anything else other than Mira Awad after that amazing conversation. This is one of her many great songs. This is Bakra, which means tomorrow.
عن بيت كانوا معاد وعن ناس ما إلها بلاد قصة عم تنتسب عن دخان ونار وعن ناس مش أحرار وعن أولاد صغار هاللي بدل ما يلعبوا عم يرموا حجار ما رح ننسى بس بكرة يوم جديد وهالطريق بتوصل لبعيد خلينا احنا سوا نمشي فيها ايد في ايد بعد شوي الشمس بتغيب تتركني لحالي بهالبلد غريب لو يرجع عن قريب Always something in the air I cannot explain All the hurt we hold in vain The tears we ever shed, promises we made of better times yet to arrive. Hope that will not fade. I reach out to you, I try to hang on tight. Something tells me we will pull through, something tells me we will be all.
Yeah.
And that was Mira Awad with Bakra. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. Now, our next guest is someone bringing highbrow art theory down to a more manageable level, child height, to be precise. Marion Duchars is an illustrator whose work has appeared in places from the Royal Mail stamps to The Guardian. And her latest book, Bob the Artist, is designed to bring art education to kids.
It follows the title character, eponymous blackbird Bob, who's teased for having spindly legs. But one day Bob visits an art gallery and discovers not only new inspiration, but his own self-worth through the works of masters such as Henri Matisse, Jackson Pollock and Bridget Riley. And the author joins us now to tell us why the art world can teach us a few useful lessons for life too. Marion, thank you for coming
on
the show. You've done a series of books that have been about the art world, but for kids. Is this because you have a kind of a brood of kids yourself, or you just felt that there was a gap here, that there were things about self-worth and inspiration that we somehow didn't explain in the art world very well to younger people?
I do have a couple of kids, and I suppose, you know, the thing about, I was an artist obviously before I had kids, but having children opens up all those doors as to that freedom that you may have lost as an artist. So I think partly having children helped me start thinking of books for children. So my first books were actually art activity books, which was to encourage children to make things with their hands, which they don't really need encouragement, but I think parents need encouragement quite often, actually, to, you know, not be scared of kind of throwing yourself headfirst into art. But this is my first storybook, and I think I always wanted to do a storybook, and they seem really easy to do, but actually that's a very difficult genre to do.
Yeah, most authors say it's like one of them, it looks simple, but it's one of the most painful and complicated things you can do. Is that because you have a bit of market research to be done all the time with other kids and seeing if they understand the characters, etc.?
I think it's a funny thing. They're deceptively simple because it's just a little storybook and you can write a story, but ultimately it's a story, and all, regardless of age, a good story is a good story, isn't it? And it's just that you have to simplify it and simplify it. And most picture books now are under 500 words, which it really is a tiny amount of wording going on. So it's trying to say a story that kind of comes around and makes a point, and as they call it, an orange, actually, in my writing class.
An orange.
Yes, it's like, it has no edges and no ambiguity and no abstraction. It's like, you know where you are, you know where you're going, you know, it's, you know, you kind of, there's no loose ends, basically. So it has to all make sense. And it generally has to be fairly positive, I think, as well.
What is it about the art world and its struggles with engaging children? Is it just because art is actually, on the whole, relatively complicated and you need to be grown up to understand it? Or is it just that, you know, art ignores children?
I don't think children? It's complicated at all. I think, it's quite a complex subject once you get further down the line, once they get older. But at that early age, I think children don't have any problems with art. Like I said, again, I think it's back to the parents sometimes feeling like they don't have the knowledge or they don't know what to teach them. But I think children are natural artists, and if you just need to give them materials and they will do amazing things with those. In fact, if anything, they don't need too much direction. I think it's just, you know, what I've said in my activity books is making a space for children to make a mess, which seems really basic and really simple, but the amount of people who are not doing that now because we are on a lot of screen time. And really, if you just create a play desk and create a space to make things, whether it's with bits of cardboard or, you know, cutting or sticking and paint, children will do amazing things. They will always surprise you. So it's giving them the space sometimes, I think, and being open to not telling them what to do that's more important.
Does it worry you that actually, as you say, you know, there's a lot of screen time now? If you're in a pub at lunchtime 10 years ago, you might have seen some kids in a corner. You know, their parents have let them go off to draw, but now they're maybe under the table on an iPad.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to judge other parents, but the one thing I've never allowed with my kids is to have any screen time at the table or in restaurants. And I've just done something very, very simple from a really young age, which was to in my bag always have paper and pencil. It's the most easiest thing to have in your bag. And as soon as we get to a restaurant or go out to anyone's house where there's time to kill, they kind of look at me like to say, well, where's the pen and pencils? They're so programmed into like drawing.
Very well trained now.
When they sit down. But they, you know, that piece of paper is a world, is an adventure, isn't it? They can go anywhere with that piece of paper and a pencil if you teach them to get excited about that piece of paper. That it's just, it can be, it's whatever they've been reading, it's whatever they've been watching on TV. It's I mean, my kids sometimes used to draw computer games, you know, obviously very deprived. No, they did have, obviously they have screen time too, but they would draw their characters from those games. And I think that was great to see, is this whole circle thing of it coming round. So.
We did a very interesting piece here some time ago in the magazine, which was talking to like a psychologist about how kids take in information these days, and saying that even what they remember and absorb, there's something about if you've used your hand to draw something, if you've seen something on paper that's tactile, just the absorption rate of that knowledge is so much deeper than when you see things on a screen and you flick and it's gone. It's that deeper connection. I wanted to ask you on the same kind of theme. Your work it's purely analog then, because when I look at your work here, also the work that you've done for a restaurant group here in the UK, for other people's book jackets, for stamps, there is a kind of a hand movement in a huge amount of it, a brush stroke, an interesting use of colour. Are you literally sitting down with a piece of paper, a coffee mug, and a worried look as you kind of start each day?
No, I mean, I do work with traditional materials, but that's because that was my working method. And obviously you can do everything on screen now, but it seems a bit silly to change it. If I can make a great paintbrush mark, why would I try to learn to do that with a brush on a software program? But I mean, ultimately everything goes through technology now, everything goes through a screen. And I love the combination of, I love being on what I call my play desk. I have one too. And it's a fantastic space to be. It's a place where I feel very happy. But all that stuff I make on that desk that's made with conventional materials does end up going through the process of a computer. But all that's doing for me is being able to cut and chop and paste and sometimes change colours and clean it up a bit. But ultimately, I like the fact that, yeah, most of the time it's kind of spent. It just feels a bit, for me, it feels a bit healthier. I know I feel better when I've worked on my play desk. When I've worked too long on my screen, I don't move enough. So I just kind of, it does fantastic things too. I can't do without both. I can't do without both, basically.
Do you feel now that you're trying to focus more on connecting children to the art world than perhaps you used to do?
When I try to think, when I do all of my books, actually, I really try, the strongest thing I think I try to do is make it very accessible. Because I think when I've looked at previous books on art, I found them quite hard to penetrate. Even as an adult, when I've sometimes looked at how-to books, I just don't understand them. So whether it's because I'm very simple and I just need to understand things on a very basic level, I want parents to be able to look at my books and be able to think, I can do that with my child. I can understand this. And I will really check some things out very well before I put it in the book. And I mean, obviously this is a storybook, so there's less activity, but it's the idea that, I do drag my kids to art museums, and that's a lot of the book is inspired by the Matisse exhibition that was on in London this year. And it was so fantastic to see collage on a massive scale, and I think even they were quite surprised. I mean, I'm not saying my kids love going to every art gallery.
Well, you said drag.
Yeah,
as
I drag them because they quite often go, can we go? Sometimes I have to balance it. We'll say, well, we'll go to the comic shop afterwards, So I think it's fair enough to say you can't expect your children to always, they're not trained like little monkeys that they love to come everywhere I'm going. But when they go there, they always enjoy it. That's what I know, once I get them in there. Because I kind of just let them go freestyle into exhibitions and let them go where they want to go. If they want to do it back to front, if they want to spend 5 minutes in front of one picture or no time in front of another, it's fine. I just think anything they get from it is very positive. So it's not very prescriptive. I don't go around and say we should take notes or we should stare at this painting because this is the most important one. I kind of quite like watching them, seeing how they interact with the show, actually. So, it's fascinating to watch. There's been some amazing shows in London this year, actually, Ai Weiwei. And I know they've all had an influence on my kids. So they've all I would say drag your kids along to the art galleries, actually.
Now, Bob has spindly legs and he finds some kind of solution for his fretting about his kind of spindly legness through the art world. Lots of kids we know are kind of like have loads of questions about their body image and how they fit in and do they look like their best friend, etc., etc. Interesting you chose a boy in a way. Bob is a boy who's kind of worried about his looks and his appearance. Is this something that comes up with other people you know who have kids and things, that this is actually just a prevalent thing that's interesting to tap into, that boys, girls at a very young age are already kind of unsure about their looks and their appearance?
I think it's quite a hot topic at the moment, but to be truthful, I did look, there's an element of it's slightly autobiographical, but also my brother, who's called Robert, was kind of the skinniest, and I hope he's not going to listen to this.
How does he feel about this?
I have told him I've written a book about him, but he lives in New Zealand, he's far away.
Okay.
But he was possibly the skinniest boy I've ever known. And we both were very skinny, and we both had very skinny legs. And I was trying to tap into that feeling of how important it was at the time, of how you cared so much about little things that you didn't like about yourself. And we can laugh about it now as adults, but at the time it was so major. And I used to wear two pairs of trousers, you know, one pair tracksuit bottoms under my jeans to make my legs look bigger. And my brother and I used to we used to eat a lot. We just didn't know. I don't know what happened to it, but we used to compensate for our, we were aware of being skinnier than other kids. But I think in the end, you know, you do have to find something you're good at, and it doesn't have to be art, but you kind of have to concentrate on your strengths in a way. So you start to learn to like what you have about yourself, and you might think, okay, my legs are pretty skinny, which they're not now, but they were, and I'll do other things. And I used to be good at sports, for example, at school. I was good at art at school, and I used to kind of compensate with those things. I used to kind of, you know, work
and
hard.
I guess,
at those.
I guess the art world is also a space where being different is the most important thing. You don't want to be the same as everybody else. You want to have some kind of exceptionalism about your talent and your skill.
You do,
skill.
But as a child, I don't think you think like that. I think you do just kind of, you don't want to stand out that much as a child.
You think, how can I become popular?
Yeah, you want to be popular. And you can become, I used to become popular by making drawings for people. You know, can you draw me my favourite pop star? Can you draw? So, you know, like I said, you're compensating. And in the end, it's about acceptance of yourself. So I know that topic was, it's something that every child, if you ask them, has got something, even from a really young age, that they don't like about themselves. And really, we've got to always make sure that doesn't manifest into something much stronger. I mean, it's really corny, but you've got to say you've got to love yourself and you've got to like what you have about yourself. If you've got a huge big nose, you've got to learn to love that nose rather than just thinking I'm going to change it.
And as Bob the artist finds out, you know, he does learn to love his beak, doesn't he?
He does. He learns to realise it's not that, okay, he's got skinny legs. It doesn't really matter. He has other talents. He has other things that people are going to love him for, whether it's his personality or he happens to be, you know, making magnificent painted beaks.
We all need our talents. Marion Deschaux, thank you very much for joining us today. The book is Bob the Artist, and it's out right now.
Joel Harrison and Neil Ridley are experts in the world of whisky. Their book, Distilled, was voted Fortnum & Mason Drink Book of the Year 2015. But for the past 6 years, the duo have been slowly but surely working on a very different kind of project, and one which they hope will highlight some of the globe's more obscure drams.
Working their way through the letters of the alphabet, Harrison and Ridley are showcasing a different rare batch of drinks for each letter. And the themes are as random as you might hope for such an obtuse idea. The last letter, D, saw them distribute a whisky called 3D, which was the first food and drink product to come with printable 3D packaging. Who knew you actually needed such a thing? Now they've moved on to the letter E and a batch that they're calling Exile Casks. Joel and Neil, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Hello. Thank you.
And you have in front of you something to do with Exile Cast. We'll come on to that in a moment. But first of all, is this a bit of a moment for whisky?
It is. Whiskey has grown in stature over the last, I would say, 4 or 5 years. There is something that we call in the industry the Mad Men effect, which is this idea of whiskey becoming a very approachable product. It's got a kind of vintage heritage to it, and yet people can see the handcrafted and artisanal ideals behind it, all those
kind of
zeitgeisty
words. And yet
we're
not necessarily
words.
Drinking it in our offices.
Well, you know,
not quite
up to
like
you. Post 5 o'clock on a Friday is your call. But, you know, that idea that it's become part of a fabric of culture these days, in as much as music has and art has, drink is one of those things that we use in our leisure time to relax and to define ourselves as well.
Is that 100% true? I want to press you on this. As someone who's been around for quite a long time, probably a bit longer than you, I have seen many attempts at saying that whiskey is having its moment. It's kind of cool. And it never seems to kind of have that moment of, you know, that 80s moment that vodka had, for example, and that kind of huge breakthrough moment where suddenly, you know, the advertising language and everything kind of really catches up. And we see the connections with, you know, rap stars with whiskey and the attempts to kind of make it a little bit hipper. But it's part of the reason it's a success. I worry that it's because it's being mixed with other things, that there's a cocktail renaissance, you know, the speakeasy renaissance. Do you feel that in, you know, in part, Joel, it's down to that?
Well, I think you have to separate it out to things like scotch. And scotch is traditionally seen as a very premium product. So
just pause one idiot. Mm. Explain to us idiots, rather, for an idiot moment, what scotch, whiskey with an E, yep. what are we talking about?
So really, there are two types of main whiskey you'd look at. There's American whiskey, which is often spelt with an E. And that's made of a mash bill of corn, usually 51% corn, and then rye and malt and other things in there. And it's matured for a much shorter period of time in very hot environment in the south of America. So that gives you a very fruity, very kind of rich, woody feel. And it's great for mixing, great for a Manhattan, great for an old fashioned, that sort of style of things. Then on the other hand, you've got scotch. Scotch is made from usually, or single malt scotch is made from 100% malted barley. It's matured for a minimum of 3 years in Scotland with just three ingredients, water, barley and yeast. And that's found a real premium home across the globe. So places like, I mean, we were in Taipei a couple of months ago and people can't get enough of it out there. Japan, it's got a real foothold. Some of the emerging markets like Vietnam, really, really wonderful to define.
So on the product scale, that's the bit that you like.
Yeah, I think it's certainly interesting to see how it's forged its way forward into a cultural environment and something that is really quite an agricultural product. You know, scotch is something that's made in small batches in copper pot stills using barley water and yeast. It's something that's found a home.
And
to
then
people
are drinking it pure, not just mixed.
Yeah, drinking it with water, a little bit of dash of water, a little bit of ice, but also places like Japan and in Tokyo, drinking in highballs with sparkling water and lemon and some ice. And it's sort of almost a take on a more savoury gin and tonic. It's a fantastic way to consume scotch.
And Neil, is that then perhaps one of the challenges that the whisky industry has, is that if it is being done in small batches when it's at its best, that it can't be mass marketed perhaps as the way that Andrew's suggesting with vodka?
I would throw another element to Scotch whisky making in, as well as malted barley, water and yeast, and that's time. Now, one of the most important things about Scotch whisky is time, the time it takes to mature, but really the time it's taken for Scotch whisky to sort of gain a foothold. There is inherent provenance in the Scotch whisky business. And I think that's one of those things which is really key to its success internationally. People are tending to drink better. So they're not drinking as much, but they're making better choices about what they're drinking. And I think because of that, Scotch has got a real provenance to it. There is a premium angle to Scotch, which I think other spirits don't have. It's now approaching, I would say, a more luxurious sort of feel.
Let's turn our attention to your alphabet project, as I'm deciding to name it. Do you have a name for it?
Just the A to Z of whiskies, I think.
Okay, the A to Z of whiskies. Fine. We can do that. And we're on to E, Exile Cask. First of all, before you tell us about this one indeed, what was the idea behind the project?
Well, in 2010, Neil and I had been writing about whisky for a good few years, and we decided, let's find something interesting to put out that might be a cask that just to celebrate what we do writing about whiskey. So we went to some Scottish islands and some Scottish mainland distilleries, and we secured a cask of Arran single cask malt whiskey. only 96 bottles in the cask, and we released that. And then we went on to do a second one, which happened to be a Benriach. So that began with
Zin. So this was an accident?
Sort of, yeah. It certainly wasn't initially by design, like all great things, like penicillin, you know. It just sort of happened and the world loves it. So off we went on this journey, and then from there we went to C, which was a blended Cutty Sark whiskey, and then on to D, which we really started to push the boundaries of bringing some interesting elements in, such as the printable 3D packaging. Mm. And now we're on to our letter E.
And are we about to try some of this?
We can try some of this. Just to add to that, I think it was something which gave us license to lark around a little bit, but also sort of colour to the edges of Scotch whisky releases. I think for us, doing it independently, we could take something which was quite new, quite innovative, especially with the last one we did, 3D. The idea of mixing old school and new school for us, the bottle came with an old school pair of 3D glasses and the label was stereoscopic. It was in a way a fun project to do, but actually it had a sort of serious angle of, look what we can do here. We can bring together three distilleries beginning with D, blend those together and come out with something completely unique, really.
I should explain to listeners that Neil, it's a small medicine almost style bottle, and Neil has pulled out the cork, and already the room is filling with an aroma, which is, what is that burning off that we smell?
Scotch whiskey has to be a minimum of 40% ABV. What we have tried to do with all our releases is bring cask strength whiskey, so whiskey that is drawn directly from the oak cask that it's been matured in at the strength that you find it in that cask. Whiskey now is, Scotch whiskey certainly is developing, it's kind of a mythical thing, it's quite an investable product, it's very collectible, there's a lot of people trading it like they would wine and art. But we also don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, but we also think whiskey is there for drinking. So what we've tried to do with Exiles is spend the last 3 years in Scotland diving through warehouses, finding casks of whiskey that have kind of been lost and undiscovered, and bottling them. And we're going to be releasing them at a price to drink, really. That's the
point. So just tell us what we're about to drink, then.
Okay, so what we have here, this is the first release for Exiles. This is 25 years old. It's at cask strength. So what you're going to be drinking here is a strong, powerful, complex flavoured whiskey. If you think about what you were doing 25 years ago, I mean, I'm trying to think about what I was doing 25 days ago. It was very, very tricky for me to think that. But to spend that amount of time in an oak cask, it's going to take on complexity. It's going to get some balance as well. It's going to slowly soften over time. And what it's going to do, it's going to take on some of the wonderful flavours of the wood. So you're going to find lots of vanilla in there. You're going to find lots of sort of buttery richness as well. Some floral notes as well. And whiskey will change enormously from the age. It has to be 3 years old to be called a whiskey. But in between 3 and 10 and 12 and 15 and 18, and then older than that, you're going to start finding lots of lovely, subtle, rich notes. And that's one of the things that drew us to this particular cask. It was a monumental find, actually, Joel, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Are you getting these subtle, rich notes?
It smells extraordinary. Just tell me, is there a peak moment, though? Is there, actually, when you get to like 30 years, you're beginning to come down the other side of the hill?
Absolutely. That's a very good question. Yeah,
you do find that things can get a bit tired, a bit over-oaked, and it just needs to come out of cask. So something that is, say, 30, 40 years old, you might see that on a bottle of whiskey, doesn't necessarily guarantee it's good quality. It's a bit like a sports person, really. There's a point where they peak, and there's a point where they come into the twilight of their years. And some people can carry on playing their professional sport into their 40s and 50s. Other people peak at sort of 30, 35. And whiskey is very much like that.
You mentioned before...
We are drinking.
We are drinking.
It tastes...
Genuinely drinking.
It tastes amazing.
You mentioned before about spending a lot of time in Scotland trying to find these lost drinks. What's the whiskey industry like in Scotland at the moment? Because it had been going through a period where all the independent distilleries were being bought up.
People have always started independent distilleries, and there were big companies that eventually buy those up. We saw a real contraction in the industry in the sort of early 1980s, and there was a lot of closing of distilleries. Same thing happened in the early 1990s. Now we're hitting a boom time, lots of people expanding their distilleries, but to find whiskey that is of this age, quarter of a century old, is actually now becoming really unusual and quite difficult. Equally, this is an artisanal product, and there are a lot of casks that are being made. We were talking to one distillery company, and they were saying they only brought in the idea of keeping a digital record of their casks in the last 3 years. Till that point, everything was done on handwritten ledger.
So actually, when you say they'd been lost, some of them actually had been lost. They didn't know what they had.
I mean, this is the staggering thing. One would think with such a huge business, you'd be able to keep a track of things. Well, of course, it's like anything. If you're your logs aren't complete. I mean, it's almost impossible to know exactly just how many casks there are in Scotland. I mean, it is certainly in the many millions, spread all the way across Scotland. So on the West Coastal Islands and the Central Belt, up in the Highlands and the Lowlands, there's a lot of warehousing. And one of the things for us was the idea behind Exiles was to start exploring some of the stories behind these lost casks. And one of the things we found was they'd simply slipped off the manifest. So someone said, hang on a sec, what's this one? This doesn't make sense. This shouldn't be here. What is it? Let's dip into that. And it may have been destined for a lost blend, it could have been a supermarket, it could have been something where that was no longer required. And because of that, it went back into the archives again to sort of effectively gather dust, but from our benefit in a way, to gather maturity and complexity.
Joel and Neil, thank you very much for joining us. Now, if you want to buy any of those great whiskies or find out more about what the guys are up to, head to exilecasks.com. And we're going to be back right after this.
There we are. That was a show, wasn't it?
That was a very good show. Well, I don't know, just a great run of things. It's amazing to meet someone who's been on Eurovision, who used that in such a fascinating kind of way. And I think that's the funny thing about Eurovision. We cover it in depth a little bit here at Monocle 24, because we've seen everybody from, you know, Conchita Wurst challenging people about what gender stereotypes are to politics. All sorts of things seep through that contest in a way that when you're not looking, almost.
Indeed, and as you suggested as well, with Israel, Mira Awad wasn't the first Israeli contestant to make us think differently of Israel. There was, of course, Dana International.
Yeah, this is somebody again who upset many of the kind of more orthodox people in that country by challenging things about the gay world as well. So yeah, an amazing thing. And then Marion Desharnais, really wonderful to meet her. The book is beautiful. And as I said, you know, when the craft of being a designer, how great that she gets to do all those different things.
I know, it's amazing. And it is, the book is really a work of art in itself. And of course, then we ended with a bit of whiskey, which has, we're reliably informed, has stunk out Studio One here at Midori House. So whoever is in here next, apologies. But yes, that was not a bad show for number 349, was it?
It was very nice indeed. We should thank our team. Tom Hall, as ever, was our fine producer. And our studio manager was Claire Urban.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, probably with Andrew and Rob. But from me, Steve Bloomfield.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Goodbye.